Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The last time we gathered around this table for our Monday podcast, President Trump had tweeted the day before telling four progressive Democratic congresswomen of color to, quote, go back and help fix the totally broken crime-infested places from which they came, end of the quote. That appeared to set the tone for the week. On Wednesday at a rally in North Carolina, while Trump criticized one of those lawmakers, Representative Ilhan Omar, the crowd broke out into chants of send her back. Here's some audio.
Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
Now, you can debate whether Trump's racist tweets were the expression of his actual feelings, a deliberate re-election strategy, or both. But what we want to try to answer today is, if it is a strategy for winning in 2020, how receptive are Americans to the message? And here with me to try to answer that question, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going good. Thank you, Galen.
Also with us is politics editor Sarah Frostenson. How are you?
Hey, Galen. Good.
Welcome. And also here with us is senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. joining us from Kentucky. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great.
And also, of course, Claire and Micah are out today.
Of course.
Well, I mean, obviously, I just introduced a bunch of people who aren't Claire and Micah. They're on vacation. They're enjoying themselves somewhere, not with us today. Also, later in the show, we are going to discuss the recently announced lineups for the second Democratic primary debate. And I should say here that we are going to be at those debates in Detroit next week. And we're going to be taping a live show in downtown Detroit while we're there. It's on Thursday, August 1st. And if you're in Detroit or the surrounding area, go get tickets at 538.com/live. It'll be a good time. In any case, let's begin with the events of the past week. And we'll start with this. Does it appear that Trump believes that stoking racial tensions is a good re-election strategy for 2020?
That seems fairly self-evident. And it also seems like there's enough reporting around this that, like, the president certainly thinks it's compatible with winning re-election. Now, I think people are extremely capable of behaviors that they like, that they feel good about, behaviors that conform to their own prejudices. I think lots of people are extremely clever about rationalizing, this is also good for me strategically or electorally or good for my career or good for whatever else. And so I somewhat object to any implication that Trump is doing this solely as a strategy and that it cannot also reflect his own racist tendencies. And also we're going to debate today, like, the fact that Trump thinks it's a good idea politically doesn't necessarily mean that it is. Trump thought the government shutdown was a good idea politically, and that was, I think, he might even admit, a kind of unmitigated disaster for him politically. But I think it's safe to say that he believes that this is at least compatible with winning re-election, if not helpful.
Perry and Sarah, does that sound about right to the two of you?
Yes. I think he saw some level of success with it in the 2016 primaries. Whether that translates to success in the general remains to be seen. I think a lot of what we saw in 2016 was two unpopular candidates, so it's hard to know how much of an impact it had or didn't. But I don't think he's changing course, to Nate's point.
Since 2016, there's been somewhat of a debate about whether economic anxiety or racial animus motivated people to vote for Trump. There's been various academic studies done on this topic. At this point, what do we know about that debate?
So there was a lot of research done during the primaries, which basically suggested, and it goes to sort of what you think and just watching it, was that people who scored high on these kind of tests of racial resentment, who were more likely to be wary of immigration overall. If you ask them, you know, why are black people poor? Is it because they're, you know, not hardworking, or is it because of discrimination? They're more likely to say because they're not hardworking. If you look at these sort of tests of racial views, particularly during the Republican Republican primary, you saw that Trump won those kinds of voters much more than the other candidates did. And that fits what you saw during the primary. During the primary, you had basically, you know, 12 candidates who were anti-abortion and anti-Obamacare. And one thing that Trump distinguished himself with was proposals like the Build the Wall and the Muslim ban. So I do think in the primary, a lot of the research suggests the immigration positions and things like that were very significant to him winning. In the general election, it's a little bit more complicated, I would say. A lot of the research shows something similar, which is that some voters, even some who voted for Obama, who in 2012, who scored high on these racial resentment examinations, maybe flipped over to Trump. Some of the research argues that basically the voters who were most primed to move on these kind of racial issues were whites without degrees, and they were disproportionately in places like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. So Trump may have turned off some voters in the suburbs, but he turned off the voters who didn't electorally matter, but also won a lot of votes and won voters sort of in the right places. In other words, the research suggests pretty clearly that the people who are particularly drawn to Trump is more about race than it is economic. So I think that's worth saying. That said, when you're talking about a two-party election, the biggest factor in the 2016 election was partisanship. Essentially, what I've always thought was the most important thing about 2016 was that not necessarily the vote changers, but Mitt Romney and Donald Trump were very different candidates, I would argue, but were treated very similarly by the Republican electorate. 80% of the people, more than 80% of the people who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012 voted for Donald Trump. So in other words, that, you know, some voters may have changed their party affiliation based on how Trump talked about race, but overall, most voters stuck with the party they were with. So the biggest factor in 2016 was, it's obvious to say, but sort of partisanship. And I do think it's a little harder to say, to isolate the racial comments in the context of an election where the FBI is investigating Hillary. You have a big partisanship part. You have, as Sarah noted, both candidates are hated. So that's my sense of it, is like the general election is harder than the primary. And we can talk about 2018 later potentially as well.
Yeah. Nate, what do you make of the research on this topic?
I think the research is relatively clear that racial anxiety outperforms so-called economic anxiety as a measure of Trump support. I don't think it's that close. And this also kind of includes research I've done myself on the topic. In general, the closer a variable you have in a, say, regression model comes to actually measuring feelings about racial resentment, the more it predicts support for Trump and the more robust it is when you insert other factors. We've read some research that says this can actually run a little bit both ways, that you support Trump for reasons that you might find a little hard to articulate, and then you begin to like adopt his views on race. So the causality isn't like totally clean. But, you know, just in terms of like kind of economic anxiety, so I did a study in the primaries, simple study based on exit polls. It showed that the average Trump voter, the median Trump voter, had an income of $72,000 a year in the GOP primaries, which is pretty decent. If you look at the general election, voters who made $50,000 or less went for Clinton, 53 to 41. Many of them are black and Hispanic, but not all. Trump won voters 50K or more by a point, 48 to 47. I think the evidence is fairly clear. We also did studies showing that, like, if you look at what actually predicted Trump's support and you don't look at race, then education's a lot more correlated with Trump support. And people know this now, right, because of the Democrats' success in college-educated towns and counties and their problems in towns where you have a lot of people who don't have college degrees. But, you know, education in the first place is a better correlate by a lot of Trump support than income and economic circumstances per se. And again, you can argue that too. You can say, well, I think there's a good argument actually that like education is a better proxy for class in the U.S. This is really about class and a certain type of class and a certain type of class in terms of how much cultural currency you have. I can buy that argument. And I think that is kind of intimately related, although not exactly overlapping with people who might be more prone toward racial bias. But I think the economic anxiety arguments were never very good and were made for people that were trying to, like, you know, make a broader point about populism. I think this latest strategy, if that's what you want to call it, by Trump, ought to put out the last embers of the economic anxiety fire.
Sarah, where did that idea come from? Why did that have such a strong pull? It seems like in the press, or even among some people on the left, who say the way to win back the Trump voter is through economic populism, because apparently that is why they voted for Trump.
I think we saw with his coalition, he was both able to activate the racial resentment we're talking about among white voters, but then also you saw people saying that they were attracted to increased Social Security benefits. So there was this idea, at least presented in the press, that they were both equally compelling for Trump's candidacy, I think, where it's he's offering both tougher regulations regarding immigration, coming into the country, building the wall, but then he's also promising to put American jobs first. So there was a conflation between the two, with the idea being, I think, too, for Democrats now here in 2018, saying, look, let's not talk about race. Let's talk about health care. Let's talk about the economy and what Democrats can do on that front. The idea being that maybe we don't have to talk about race in the Midwest to win back those voters.
A lot of times when we talk about indicators of how someone will vote, it's gender or age or race or whether or not they have a college degree. Those are kind of straightforward things to judge in a survey. How do you go about discerning what makes somebody vote based on racial animus? What's underlying there? Like, how can you tell that it's racial animus, or why do particular people vote based on racial animus? It seems a little more complex than oftentimes the indicators that we're talking about in surveys.
I mean, it is complicated. You know, if you're doing some type of, again, regression analysis is the idea of you're trying to actually not determine causality, but infer which variables are most predictive, controlling for other variables. So if you're doing that, one thing you have to be careful of, this is not a model talk, so I'm not going to go on too long about it, right? You probably don't want to mix like attitudinal variables and phenotypic or demographic variables, because attitudinal variables kind of hit a lot closer to the mark in terms of how do people feel about politics. And a question can be something like, there are kind of clever phrasings that people use to try to soften like racist arguments, right? They'd be like, immigrant groups like Italians, the Irish, and the Jews work their way up through society, right? And pay their dues. Do you feel blacks should do the same thing, right? It's still fairly transparently racist, but if you're like kind of, you know, a little bit sheepish about admitting you're racist, you'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, let's just do what the Italians did or whatever else. But, you know, when you
and do, so answering yes to that question then becomes an indicator of support for Trump.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a stronger indicator than if you ask a battery of questions that touch upon economic populism, for example.
And are there underlying then factors that we can look at, like which kinds of voters are most likely to have those racial resentments?
I'm going to play the this is over my head card on that. Like, I don't claim to have proprietary knowledge about like
what
the roots of
racism.
Yeah. So I'm operating on a slightly more superficial level in terms of like how much do evidently racist attitudes kind of predict political behavior.
Mm-hmm.
What I was trying to get at, and maybe I'll be curious what Nate says too, is I think it's without digging into the racial resentment scores too much, because that's a kind of, it's a hard concept. Just my sort of non-data, sort of commonsensical view of this is that in a Republican primary where 17 people ran who all had the same views except Trump's, the most unique thing was Trump's views on racial issues. I think it's pretty easy to say Trump won the primary, and a big factor of that was immigration and how he talked about that. In the general election, if you ask me, was Trump's strategy of talking about race the way he did smart for the general election 2016? I think my answer is I don't know. And my answer would be I'm not sure, because there was so much else going on that the question of was this good a good strategy is one I don't feel very equipped to answer. Mm-hmm. Because if maybe a normal Republican who was less controversial may have actually won by more.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. If we're talking about common sense in a way, if we look at American history, have people been able to win elections based on racist appeals?
Well, sure. I mean, what do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, so in a way, it wouldn't be shocking that it would happen again, right?
Like, the entire history of American politics in some ways revolves around race and slavery. But to the point Perry was alluding to before, what Trump accomplished, and you can send... Don't tweet at me, but you can send your hate mail, you know, to, you can figure out my email address and send your hate mail there, right? What Trump accomplished in the general election was not that impressive, given that usually when you have a party that's had two terms, it's kind of a 50-50 election, that Hillary Clinton was really unpopular. He lost the popular vote by, what was it, 3 million votes or something, 2.1 percentage points, and kind of had the election given to him because of the Electoral College, which is a rule of the game. It's not like it was a surprise to Clinton. Probably should have campaigned in Michigan and Wisconsin more. But the Electoral College, as populations are currently divided between states, really gives a disproportionate influence to states that are more white and to states that are more working class, especially in the Midwest. And so you're talking about, like, Trump and or the Republicans' strategy for using racial appeals to win over a certain type of white voter. We have to talk about the fact that white voters are overrepresented in the Electoral College, overrepresented even to a much, much, much greater degree in the Senate, and actually kind of less than the House of Representatives. And you saw some problems that Republicans had in 2018 in these more wealthy, progressive suburbs that are often somewhat mixed race, even they're predominantly white, and where the community is college educated. Those are areas that are turning away from the GOP. But again, where did Democrats make a lot of gains? Now, a lot of it was in states like New Jersey and Texas and California and parts of New York. Those states, with the exception of Texas, and we're not having a big electoral debate here, don't really help the Democrats that much in the Electoral College.
So are you making the argument that appealing to American voters based on racism, racial resentment, differences amongst different groups of people in America, and immigration is a good strategy for Trump in 2020?
I mean, with all that said, I tend to think, you know, if it had been Mitt Romney running against Clinton or Marco Rubio or John Kasich or I don't know, right? They could easily have won by 6 points and maybe not have won that many more states. But who knows? I mean, Clinton was really unpopular. And there's a whole other question of, like, gender-related bias, right?
Sarah, what do you think about this? You know, it's a difficult question, right? Like, is racism a good election strategy is basically the question.
No, I don't think. I think it helped Trump, as we've all said, stand out in the primary. That was a predictive factor for those who were going to support him. For the general, provided that he is up against a different candidate and we don't have the same favorability problems that are embedded in that, research shows that overall, Americans aren't getting more racist. If anything, they're getting less. And that's happened since Trump's been elected. And part of it is driven by white Democrats, right? It is becoming increasingly within that party that it is important that Americans of all backgrounds have equal rights, right? But also, a study that we're going to be publishing later this week by Dan Hopkins found that it's not just white Democrats. It's Republicans, too. And on average, both anti-black prejudice and anti-Hispanic prejudice has dropped from 2016 to now. And so, to some extent, and Nate's written about this, Perry's written about this on the site, Trump's base and activating that base on these racial fears won't be enough going forward, I think, for 2020. And again, he doesn't need to stand out against other Republicans this time. He needs to stand out against who the Democrats nominate.
I don't know. I mean, I guess the core question is racist appeals and the way he talks about race a good strategy? And the answer is, I just don't think there's, I think the reason people debate the subject so intensely is we don't know, because ultimately the way he campaigned in 2016 was fairly unique. You know, Mitt Romney, Ronald Reagan, every moderate Republican has done, even Bill Clinton, for that matter, some Democrats have done some kind of dog whistle to white people moves that were sort of anti-black or anti-Latino in a certain way. Trump was, I would argue, sort of unique in sort of being upfront about it, particularly in a increasingly multiracial country. I was surprised that Donald Trump won the presidency after the black person was president in the manner he did. I was surprised by that. I don't think I thought it would work. And it would be hard for me to look at the strategy and say, this is a good one, considering the midterms we just saw. But it'd be hard for me to say it's a bad strategy, considering, as Nate said, that Wisconsin is probably the tipping point. I know there's some debate about this, but it'd be hard to win the election for either party without winning Wisconsin. And I do think Wisconsin might be a place that has a lot of whites without degrees who are not super urban. So it might be a good strategy for those. So I just think it's a really hard question. I think that's part of the AOC versus the New Dems, as part of the Biden versus Kamala Harris. This sort of how sort of racist is the electorate question is underlying everything.
And I do think it's a question for deep, kind of historically grounded research and history it's not so much a question for kind of glib punditry, even relative to other questions. It's not so much a question for, I mean, reporting can help, I think, but the classic kind of Trump voters in a diner in Ohio kind of reporting, I think maybe doesn't really shed that much light on it necessarily. But I do want to, again, reemphasize another point that Perry made, which is like you had a lot of Republicans who, even though they may say that they're becoming more aware of racial prejudice by whites toward non-whites, were and largely are still willing and probably will be still willing to vote for President Trump despite that, because they find the other side objectionable, because they like the economy, because they think maybe in some sense there's like the take Trump seriously, but not literally, whatever the hell that meant, right? But you did have Trump receiving the normal levels of support among Republican voters. And there's maybe a few people who left the GOP, and so, but that's like not that large an effect.
Yeah, Perry brought up 2018 as an example of maybe this strategy not working. What can we say in regard to the 2018 midterms that can shed some light on this discussion?
My look at 2018 suggests that, 2018 showed that Clinton won white voters with college degrees by a small margin, and that margin got a little bit bigger in 2018. And also, most of the big wins for the Democrats were in the suburbs of like Atlanta or in New Jersey or what have you. So we're talking about the same kind of, all evidence suggests that Trump is turning off certain Republican swing voters and people who probably are not particularly poor and were not going to lose their health care because of the Obamacare repeal because they have jobs that give health care. There's a lot of evidence that Trump is turning off people because of the way he talks about race and culture. And I think that was a huge factor. Like, the 2018 election was marked by Democrats raising these huge sums of money in almost every race, these huge rallies against Trump and so on. And it's hard to say it was purely a rejection of how Trump talks about race, because you also had this Obamacare repeal, which was also very galvanizing for Democrats as well. But I think it's hard to look at 2018, if you look at like Beto O'Rourke's race, for example, and not see these huge growths of Democrats winning in urban and suburban areas and not think that was a backlash to how Trump talks about race. And so therefore, it's hard to say this is a good strategy if you lost control of the House with a strategy.
Part of it is like swing districts tend to be suburban districts, given that now the vote is very correlated with urban-rural status, which is correlated with education, which is correlated with racial attitudes. So yes, it gets complicated, right? Democrats actually made, relatively speaking, some strong gains in rural areas also in the midterms. But because those seats are generally not that competitive, then it wasn't enough for them to win. But there were some exceptions, like Maine's 2nd District, which went for Trump by a lot, elected a Democrat in a very close election that required Maine to go to its ranked choice voting. But that was where a GOP incumbent was knocked off, for example, in Maine's 2nd District, which is a very Trumpy district that's not traditionally Republican.
And when you're trying to win a state in a national presidential election, narrowing the margins in areas where you'll still lose makes a big difference.
Yeah, but just saying like, so there's always some degree of like reversion to the mean in midterms, and the fact that areas that shifted a lot toward Trump, number one, voters who are new to a candidate or a party may actually be some of the first ones to express regrets about that candidate or have second thoughts about that candidate. And number two, when Trump's not on the ballot, then people who might have turned out, and Trump, although turnout was quite high, obviously the midterm was very, very high. But, unlike a traditional kind of Romney-esque candidate, Trump is turning out some non-traditional voters. And so that it has fairly complicated effects.
So even if the midterms were difficult for Trump and Republicans, you're saying that that shouldn't necessarily be indicative of what will happen.
Well, the midterms are difficult because we mostly focused, the Senate wasn't that difficult. The GOP gained seats in the Senate, even though the environment was very Democratic, right? Whereas the House, you divide things into 435 buckets, and again, there is gerrymandering, but like those buckets like tend to reflect a truer cross-section of the United States than the 50 states do, where North Dakota gets as many electoral votes as New York or Texas. And so, again, just in the world where the framers had designed a different setup that doesn't give like white working class voters like a huge amount of electoral influence, then Trump would have lost the popular vote and therefore lost the election. And people would be repudiating Trumpism as a strategy, and they'd be saying, how did Trump blow this race when Hillary Clinton was so unpopular? How did he lose? And I don't know. The systemic factors here are quite important.
And just one more thing on the Electoral College. The strength of the white working class vote, is that based on which states happen to be swing states right now? And could that change in the future if the battleground states change? Like, for example, if Texas or something like that started to go blue, then all of a sudden, is it still the same dynamic where you would still say that the white working class is overweighted in representation in the Electoral College?
It will not necessarily always be true. It's based on the party coalitions that they are today. There's a very small element in which it's true, which is that the Senate deliberately gives more power to small rural states, which
counts as one elector.
Which, until there are a bunch of black people moving to South Dakota, I don't think is going to change anytime soon. But the Electoral College can be more transient, for sure. And again, we saw that where the Obama coalition, which is only subtly different than the Clinton coalition, right? But the Obama-Romney map versus the Clinton-Trump map is enough to reverse the polarity a fair bit on the Electoral College.
In reference to this, you know, realignment, even if it's slight, looking forward to the 2020 election, does it look like there's more upside for Democrats in terms of gaining ground with suburbanites and college-educated folks versus how much ground remains to be gained amongst Republicans and Trump with rural folks, non-college-educated folks, etc.?
So I was surprised in 2018, we looked at Obama-Trump districts, and then we looked at Romney-Clinton districts. And I think what we saw the electoral gains for Democrats were in the Romney-Clinton districts. But now I can't speak to what that would mean electorally, but it sounds as if, based on what Nate and Perry have said, that's not where Democrats need gains to actually change the electoral math here in 2020. So then it will come down to what does turnout mean and how will that change the map if they can't win back these Obama-Trump districts that have gotten more Republican.
Right. So basically, even if you're winning Georgia's 6th, a suburban district near Atlanta, it may not mean that you win Georgia.
Exactly.
Got it.
I think Nate was tweeting with someone and said we should not focus on which states are the tipping point states this early. And I understand and I probably agree with it. But I would say if you're looking at the states that it looks like it'll come down to right now, probably a Wisconsin, a Michigan, a Pennsylvania, I would say the Democrats probably have a lot of room to grow with A, white working class voters who maybe switched from Obama to Trump and maybe switched back in the midterms. And then B, also having more, you know, the people who voted for Jill Stein, the people who stayed home who are maybe black in Wisconsin. Those are places where you have some gains. Like, you know, Georgia and Texas probably have more of the sort of suburban voters we're talking about who flipped in the midterms. But if you're looking at these Midwest states that are heavily non-college, both black and non-black, I do think more of the potential growth there is on the getting the white working class voting for you, but also mobilizing more minority voters, particularly black voters in those states. So I think the strategy is, so it's a little bit of, I think it's almost all of the above as opposed to, I know it's a cop-out answer, but I think all of the above is probably smarter than just focusing on one group or the other.
But I guess for Trump specifically, does he have more ground to gain with making race-based arguments?
For Trump,
or did he max out basically in 2016?
I'm not sure. Like, I guess I look at the Florida election where I know it's one race, but the Florida and Georgia races, the Republicans had the advantage, but the governor's races in both those states, it looked to me like the, you know, Gillum and Abrams did do what they were supposed to do in terms of increasing turnout, but DeSantis and Kemp increased turnout too. They campaigned as kind of in a sort of Trump way. They talked about sanctuary cities. They talked about immigration, DeSantis particularly. And I do think looking at DeSantis's race, maybe the way to run if you're Trump, particularly in Florida and maybe Pennsylvania and Wisconsin as well, is to sort of almost hope for greater turnout and even bigger margins with white working class voters. And maybe don't worry about the suburban voters too much. And maybe don't worry about the minority voters too much, but really sort of double down. So I do think there's evidence that maybe the Trump strategy is to do 2016, but even more so. And maybe that'll work. I think there's good evidence for that.
I mean, I find it easier to frame it from the question of the Democrat strategy, because they have a lot more choices to make, including, most importantly, the choice of their nominee, and their message is a little bit more poorly defined. I mean, look, certainly, you know, one thing to say about this past couple of weeks with Trump is, like, if there was going to be any version of a kinder, gentler Trump, a pivot, which I don't think anyone with the brain should have been expecting.
Yeah, I don't think anybody was writing that story.
People were, though, throughout the first pivot year and a half of Trump's White House.
Not at this point.
But, you know, but Trump has chosen a strategy for better electorally or worse, right? But, yeah, it's like Democrats are in this valley, and you kind of see this, like, these two peaks that both seem sort of scalable nearby, one of which is the peak they came from, where they perform well in the upper Midwest, one of which is this other peak on which they perform well in Arizona and Georgia and perhaps Texas. And, you know, you probably want a Democrat that attempts to scale one or the other of those peaks instead of remaining in the valley.
You can't try to scale both at the same time. You just cut yourself in half and scale both at the same time.
Look, let's say that Trump loses the popular vote by 5 or 6 points, right? You could have a very satisfying looking map for Democrats, because then they would win both, right? If Democrat wins by 5 or 6 points and they win all these newfangled swing states plus the traditional swing states and the map is quite blue, but no one really gives a crap about like how the map looks like they shouldn't if you win by 5 or 6 points about who kind of actually wins by any amount and takes the White House. And so, you know, you're still at a point where if the popular vote is tied or within a point or 2 points, or some people might say 3 points.
Wait, but can you weigh in on what Perry just said in terms of Florida seems to suggest that Trump does have more ground to gain with white voters, and that, you know, that just might be a workable strategy in 2020?
Well, Florida's weird.
Well, okay, but answer the question. So are you saying no? Like, did Trump max out his score with non-college educated whites in 2016?
I don't know. There are a lot of non-college educated whites in the country. There are more non-college educated whites than there are racial minorities in the country. And so therefore,
many more than college educated whites.
Yeah. And one of the whole flaws, like the whole kind of, oh, blue wall emerging Democratic majority hypothesis, was the idea that, like, the white vote is static and Hispanics and Asians will become more Democratic over time. Well, what if the white vote begins to behave more like an ethnic vote, kind of, right? People are, like, voting based on their race, and there's still a lot more white people in the country, especially among registered and likely voters, than there are among minorities, and so there's not, like, necessarily, like, an upper peak.
Right, I mean, it's something like, by population, it's white people are 60% of the country, but in the electorate, it's more like 70% of the country?
Yes.
Something like that, yeah. But Florida's weird, in part because, like, Florida's weird. But yeah, I mean, Florida is a big problem for Democrats, right? Because you would think that, like, ordinarily, as Democrats rely on this coalition, again, is, like, more urban and does well on the urban South and relies more on Hispanic voters, for example, you would think all of those things would bode well for Democrats in Florida. And it hasn't so far. Florida's been a difficult state for them. It was one of their worst states in the midterms, because the world in which Florida is now slightly blue-leaning, which you might kind of predict based on demographic model, that's a very, very different world for Trump. And that's a world in which his reelection chances are, like, considerably more tenuous, frankly.
Sarah, as we're discussing, unlike Republicans, Democrats do have to put together a racially diverse coalition in order to win the election. Of course, Republicans probably also have to win Hispanic votes in Florida and in Texas and things like that. So it's somewhat racially diverse, but not nearly similar to what Democrats would have to put together in order to win in 2020. So in an environment where Trump is making race-based appeals to voters, how do Democrats counter that message?
Right. Very easy question, Sarah.
Very, yes. No, I mean,
Sarah, can you solve racism?
I'm trying.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the problem with this is it's kind of the two peaks Nate painted for us earlier, right? And on the one side of it, it's like, let's just talk about the economy, let's not touch issues of race, kind of the Pelosi playbook for 2018, right? But then on the other side, you have all of the Democrats saying it's a turnout game, let's speak to our broader coalition, they're, you know, let's make it about identity politics, but one that is more inclusive for the rest of the country. And as to which strategy is more effective, I have no idea how to answer that. And I think a lot of it will depend on who they elect as the nominee. And if it is more of a Biden centrist candidate, I don't think you're going to have appeals to a multicultural America in the same way that you would if it was Warren, if it was Harris, if it was Buttigieg. And I do think to some extent, too, with the question of turnout, if you don't achieve turn out enough in some of these Sunbelt states to actually flip them, it'll still be an electoral disadvantage for Democrats.
Or even, I mean, we talked about Pennsylvania last week, and an important factor there is also that Hillary Clinton did not achieve the same turnout that Barack Obama did. And, you know, you could say the same about Detroit, and you could say the same about Milwaukee. So even in the Rust Belt, whoever wins the nomination, if they're going to win the general election, will still have to turn out a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition.
And I know there's been studies, you know, Sean McElwee, Data for Progress, they showed that, look, a lot of the voters who voted for Obama didn't turn out for Clinton. So that could be a winning strategy for Democrats here in 2020.
One thing that's hard to isolate from 2016 and 2018 to 2020 is we're saying the way he talks about race and identity or immigration, but those are fairly different things. Like, build the wall versus go back to your country are very different statements, one of which is pretty racist and the other, you know, it can be defined as a policy. For example, like, you know, the Muslim ban is different than the Charlottesville comments. I do... To talk about what he's doing briefly, like how the Democrats should react is complicated because what we're talking about, like Joe Biden, we're framing as the sort of the candidate who won't talk about race, but Joe Biden talks about Charlottesville all the time. Like he's talking about that too. It's hard to imagine a Democrat who won't talk about some of the divisive tactics of Trump. Joe Biden, the sort of white centrist person, is doing that. Beto O'Rourke, a white candidate, is doing that. So I don't know how easy it will be to isolate Democrats who talk about race more versus less. I think we are sort of, if we're talking about demographics of the Democrat, we should be honest about that. And I assume a woman or minority candidate will be perceived differently than a white guy candidate. But also, Gretchen Whitmer won in Michigan by a lot. I think her politics are sort of similar to like Kirsten Gillibrand's. Tony Evers won in Wisconsin. His politics are sort of like Biden's. His lieutenant governor is a man whose last name is Mandela, who's a young black man. So it's like a little bit hard to know exactly. Obama won Wisconsin by a lot. So it's not as if we have a great sense of like this strategy will win Wisconsin and Michigan with this kind of person. I think it's entirely possible that Cory Booker, if he's the nominee, might gain among whites without degrees, whites with degrees, and African Americans, like, and do similar to what Obama did. I just think these are really hard questions that are sort of unknowable. I know it's hard. I know it's not useful to say, but these are really hard questions, I think.
Well, let's start to wrap up here, but what are your closing thoughts?
I don't know if it sums everything up. Like I said before, I do think there's this kind of glib conventional wisdom that, oh, racism is helping the president, which we've talked on this podcast about many reasons why that could be the case. But I think people are like a little bit too quick to take that as like the savvy viewpoint. And there are some arguments about like how, okay, well, President Trump is using these racist statements against these four congresswomen as a way to distract voters from X, the Jeffrey Epstein allegations. Like, that analysis really seems to have its head up its ass, frankly.
Because also, like, the president distracting voters potentially from positive economic numbers.
Yeah, positive. And also the fact that, like, the president accusing four women in Congress of telling them to go back where they came from is a huge story, right? And to say, oh, it's just a distraction from this other thing that we media elites think should be more important, like, that seems really lost. But that's more of a tangent than, like, a summing it up. I mean, there's a lot we don't know is what I would say.
Well, and in fact, something we bring up often on this podcast and didn't bring up as much in this conversation is that in another world, without telling women of color in Congress to go back where they came from or Judge Curiel, etc., not only are the economic numbers decent, people feel good about the economy. Even Democrats report that they're optimistic about the economy, and you might expect a higher than 42% approval rating in another circumstance. Sarah, what are your closing thoughts?
I would echo that there's just so much that we don't know in terms of what is left for Trump to make in terms of inroads among voters that express racial resentment, what gains there are for Democrats to both juice voter turnout, regain in areas, particularly in the Midwest, that went for Trump, and how much of it will be able to see in terms of like a concrete strategy is unclear to me.
Perry?
I guess my final thought is maybe it seems to me that Trump may have had a good strategy to win the primary, And he probably should have abandoned it for the general election and probably should have abandoned it for the midterms and for the 2020 as well. But he's kind of stuck on it now. But it seems kind of obvious to me that, like, a more normal Republican behavior, if he could switch and just become John Kasich right now, it'd be a better way to win re-election. And that, yeah, we're being sort of, I agree with you, we're being sort of glib about, you know, racism is serious, but it's like, oh, it's a distraction. I'm not sure if that's true. But it just may also, I don't want to overthink the obvious here, which is that the economy's doing well and Trump is kind of constantly, you know, making people in his own party twist in knots. The House voted to, you know, censure him this week. This doesn't look like a good political strategy to me. And if you have to ask if a strategy is good or not, usually the answer is no.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. And of course, we brought up a lot of questions that I think we'll continue to discuss throughout the coming year. I mean, if this past week was any indication of what the general election will be like, I imagine we will be having a lot of conversations along these lines. But for now, let's move on to and talk about the lineup for the second debate. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs, builds, and operates workspaces for small, medium, and enterprise businesses in over 400 locations and 100 different cities around the world. WeWork and 538 have partnered to bring you The Way We Work Today, a series of articles that explores the best places to base your business in 2019. Economies and city dynamics vary from market to market, and on the 538 website, we're taking a deep dive into which ones provide the best ecosystem for your business to flourish, of course, while taking into consideration any downsides to be aware of. Factors such as the city's investment in economic development, tax incentives and rates, strength of workforce, cost of living, and public infrastructure are only a few aspects that business owners need to consider when figuring out where to base their business headquarters and satellite locations. Head over to 538.com/WeWork to learn more about that series. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. Are you tired of credit card bills with high interest rates? Ready to pay off your credit card balances and start saving money? Get a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream with rates as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. That's lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees. The rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. Plus, you can even get your money in your bank account as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. That's subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and on Thursday, CNN held a live draft in order to determine the lineups for the second Democratic primary debate. I don't know if y'all watched, but it was quite the spectacle. Real-time commentary. They saved the highest polling candidates for the end. In any case, we now know who is facing off against whom. The first night is Sanders, Warren, Buttigieg, O'Rourke, Klobuchar, Hickenlooper, Delaney, Williamson, Bullock, and Ryan. And that's next Tuesday. And then the second night, Wednesday of next week, is Biden, Harris, Booker, Yang, Castro, Gabbard, Gillibrand, Inslee, Bennett, de Blasio. I'll ask an open question to start, and then we can get into some of the specifics. Perry, what are some of the key matchups or dynamics that stick out to you in the lineups for the two nights that you're interested in watching play out?
So the first night, Steve Bullock wasn't in the last debate, so I'll be curious what he has to say. He's polling low, but he actually has a really great story. He's the one person in this race who's like really consistently done well in a real, it's purple, but it's like a Republican-leaning state. And I'd be curious to see how he talks about himself.
And that's Montana.
Montana, yes, thank you. Sanders and Warren being in the same debate is interesting because you could see a scenario where they both gain some and they're not necessarily competing each other all the time, but they are fairly ideologically similar and they're pretty friendly. So my guess is the moderators will try to goad them into a fight, and I'll be curious to see how they handle it because they sort of agree on issues and kind of like each other. And then on that same night with Sanders and Warren are Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke. And I think Mayor Pete and Beto are framing themselves as kind of the moderate candidates, and you're hearing them talk about Medicare for all and the single payer as being a bad idea and being more explicit about that. I do think this next debate, you're going to have Sanders and Warren probably attacked by the other candidates on this idea that Medicare for all and getting rid of private insurance is dangerous and complicated and electorally bad. I think you're going to hear that debate engaged. On the second night, what I'll be watching for is mainly Biden versus Harris. Looks to be personal, mean, kind of nasty. They don't like each other, and I'm excited about that. So that's good. Debates are good when they're more fraught. And then Tulsi Gabbard has been, interestingly, she's not going to be the nominee, but she has been taking Biden's side in this whole dispute and saying Kamala played the race card in the last debate. So I will be curious to see if Tulsi Gabbard on the debate stage attacks Kamala on the busing and race issues, because I think that'll put her on the defensive, having a minority woman do that. But overall, Biden versus Harris, of course, will be probably the main draw of these debates overall.
Yeah, Sarah, what dynamics are you looking at, or do you see in those lineups any particular winners or losers?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, what's interesting with this debate versus the first one was the two nights are a lot more evenly stacked when it comes to support. And that was intentional on CNN's part and the DNC's part. And I think, to echo what Perry said, the Sanders-Warren dynamic, their non-aggression pact is off. I do think you have more moderate candidates that evening. So, you know, you could see a potential winner-loser headline for the first night that's framing it for centrists versus the more progressive wing of the party and, like, which one came out stronger. I do think that, in theory, should be a big topic area for the first night. But then thinking about how the two debates worked in June, you saw that the second night overshadowed the first. So part of me wonders, will that happen again? Where, you know, this time, for instance, Castro is not on the same stage as Beto. And so it'll be harder maybe for him to have his breakout moment. And also, in terms of a breakout moment, it really didn't lead to that much of a gain in the polls for him. It was a story about Harris and Warren. I'm curious to see if that happens this time around. And I think Booker being in the mix for the Biden and Harris debate will be interesting as well.
To your point about the first night moderates against Sanders and Warren, it didn't seem like there was that much of a clash between the center and the left in the first round of debates. And in the aftermath, you heard from a lot of Democratic strategists, et cetera, like they went all in on the leftmost positions and blah, blah, blah. Should we expect more of an argument from the center in these debates?
I would think so. I realized though, I was looking again, that Bennett is not actually on the first night. I thought he, in the first debate, was really the candidate that pushed back or advocated.
And Delaney too, yeah.
Yeah, the most for the moderate position. So I realized that kind of goes counterintuitive to what I was pitching for happening the first debate. Perry had said too that Buttigieg is casting himself as more of a moderate, same as O'Rourke, definitely Klobuchar. I just don't see in what scenario Democrats on that stage, who really the third debate, as we know, it's a much higher entry both on polling and donor requirements. This is going to be the last time we see some of these candidates.
A lot of them, perhaps.
Yeah. So, I mean,
it's now or never, folks.
Exactly. And if you don't think Medicare for all works, say that. I mean, they won't be able to raise their hands this time around, but I would think if they want to stay relevant, you're going to see that.
And that was, of course, a nod to the fact that the DNC and CNN have agreed that there will be no hand-raising questions and there will be no questions that request a single-word answer in this round.
Bad decision.
So bad.
We can debate that in a second, but first I want to let Nate get in here and talk about what sticks out to him in the upcoming lineups.
I don't know. I think CNN got pretty fortunate in terms of having two kind of compelling matchups. I mean, I don't really care that much about the candidates on the wings of the stage. As you know, I'm like not very sympathetic to these crappy candidates who are polling at 1%. Although it is very important to note that like this is some of their last chance to make headway, which will probably lead to more efforts to interrupt, will probably lead to more efforts to like attack whomever they can attack and think is vulnerable, because it literally might be their kind of last major public forum unless they gain traction in the polls between now and the next debates in September.
How few people do we think may be on the debate stage in September, approximately?
8 to 10.
Yeah, 6 have qualified now, and we've still got, what, maybe a month and a half to go?
Yeah. Okay. So it'll be one debate, we think?
Yeah, I think it's one debate. Because, I mean, you also have some people reaching the fundraising limit, which is 135,000 donors now, but they're not going to crack the polling limit of
2%. Okay.
You have to hit both this time around, too. So I just, yeah, I think one night of debates.
Are we talking winners, losers?
Winners, losers. Go for it, Nate.
I think that Warren should be reasonably happy. We talked, was it last week, about kind of Warren versus Sanders and lanes, and yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than all of that, right? But, you know, I do think, number one, that she is, I mean, Bernie's a very steady debater, doesn't make a lot of gaffes, doesn't make a lot of mistakes. She is definitely, like, at least according to our panel that we surveyed last time, was the better debater, and I think has higher upside as a debater. And so I think her being able to take on Bernie one-on-one, maybe not in ways it's going to involve a lot of confrontation. I don't expect that from either of them, except for some backswiping between staffers have not largely been confrontational. But I can imagine kind of Warren saying, hey, look, I can give you all that Bernie gives, but a little bit more. I'm a little bit more dynamic. I can build a bigger coalition. I'm younger. I'm a woman in a party where three-fifths of voters are women. I'm offering something a little bit fresher. And so all you Bernie people, I love him. He loves me. But yeah, vote for me. I can win.
That's what she's trying to go for in
that It can be a soft message. So I kind of see it as low risk, high reward for Warren, potentially. Although, remember, they aren't the only two candidates, obviously. Buttigieg and Warren are competing to some extent for similar voters, right?
And that's college-educated white voters?
College-educated white voters. And O'Rourke is also competing for the same voters. I'm not sure if he really has that much of a pulse, but he's someone who, obviously, will hope to be having a better debate than last time. Amy Klobuchar being kind of the more moderate candidate, I think this is a decent setup for her. I thought in the first debate, I was the Klobuchar correspondent. We randomly picked candidates. Was a little bit too tentative to kind of stand up and say, yeah, I'm the electable, reasonable, moderate progressive, instead of the progressive leftist.
What's a moderate progressive?
I don't know. It's what I don't know. But so, you know, in the second debate, though, I don't know. I would not be real thrilled with this if I were Biden, because Harris really, really, really kind of whipped my ass in the previous debate.
Isn't it just high risk? Like, you either make your comeback and you reestablish yourself and kind of make back whatever you lost in the last
debate? No, you're right. It is.
Or, you know, Harris double downs and this is kind of, you know, your
swan. It is high risk, high reward, right? You're setting up the rematch, right? And the rematch, and maybe because the expectations are, well, Harris runs circles around him, right? It's definitely high risk, high reward. It's also the fact that I believe every non-white candidate in the field is in that second debate.
And so if your vulnerability last time was a conversation about race, then perhaps there's a lot more of that coming your way on the second night of debates for Joe Biden.
I would think so. And remember that among the candidates who need to have a good debate, although they're not, I don't think their nature of not qualifying for the third debate, but still, any candidate apart from the top four or five don't have that many more opportunities, which is not to say that you won't have some candidate break out or whatever else, right? But like Booker, I mean, what's Booker do? I think it's kind of a tough assignment because you have Harris in the center and Harris is polling a lot better than Booker. And so Booker seems a little bit squeezed there. Maybe Castro will try to follow up and have another good debate potentially. But my first instinct was that this is a good matchup for Warren, not great for Bernie, high risk for Biden. Pretty good, although also high risk for Harris, and probably better for like Buttigieg, Klobuchar, O'Rourke than for the other candidates like Booker in the second debate. But I don't know. It's probably all stuff that announcement will probably all seem stupid after we see the debates. It's all fairly superficial, but those are my initial instincts at least.
All right, Perry, we've talked about this off air, so I know that both you and I have thoughts about this topic, but the DNC and CNN have decided not to have hand-raising questions or single-word response questions anymore. How do you feel about that?
Okay, so the single words I was not a big fan of. You know, the sort of which foreign leader will you call on the first day you get at the White House?
Jacinda Ardern, girlfriend.
Yeah, well, just call, you know, schedule several calls that day. You have a phone, it works. That was a dumb question. That said, I thought the hand raising was actually very clarified, particularly on the health insurance question. Everyone raised their hand, and on the immigrants getting health care question too. I just thought the hand raising not only clarified Warren's position on health care, Harris raised her hand and then backtracked. But anyway, it sort of put them on the spot. So I think You have a group of candidates, and I'm going to say Klobuchar and Biden are in this group particularly, who want to portray themselves as moderate but also liberal and therefore don't want to say anything. Bernie Sanders will say he's for, you know, people in jail voting. He's like very open about his views. But you have four or five candidates who are trying to a little bit have it both ways, and it's hard for the moderators to pin down people. And for me, if we're going to have 10 people say, I like healthcare, people should get healthcare, why am I watching these debates? I mean, they're watching them to sort of fight each other, but I actually use these debates to learn some of their public policy stands, and now you're telling me I won't learn anything because I'm going to get a bunch of filibusters. So all I have to watch for now is to see if Biden, you know, can not fumble his way through another debate, but that's not – I actually used it a base to learn information about the candidates, and you basically told me it's not going to happen now.
Yeah, Perry, I'm on your side. As much as people made fun of those hand-raising questions, I thought it was a great way to actually learn information about the candidates. Sarah, where do you come down on that issue?
Yeah, bring him back. I'm with you guys. The hand-raising was good. It's a shame.
All right. Well, I think that is about it. Does anyone have final thoughts on what to expect for next week's debates in Detroit?
I mean, my final thought is Biden can't be that bad again. You get one mulligan, and he's still ahead in most of the polls. But I do think voters, like, the number one question for Democrats is, can you beat Trump? Biden is helped by the fact that he's a man who's not a socialist. He's a white man without a socialist, I'd probably say. But if you appear in the debates a second time to be kind of old, kind of not quick on your feet, kind of disengaged, I think this is a big problem. Like this, I don't want to say must-win debate, but Biden, I do think, has to be better this time.
It's a must-not lose.
Right.
Have a catastrophe
debate.
Or
must not be terrible.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I guess if he does do poorly again and the support doesn't just go to Warren and Harris like it did in the first, maybe I'm wrong and we'll have a lot more than 10 candidates make the third debates in September.
That could be interesting. All right. Well, I think as we say at the conclusion of every podcast, only time will tell, or we will see something along those lines. But we will actually see about the debate at least next week. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we are going to be in Detroit for those debates. We're going to have a reaction pod. We're also going to have a live show on August 1st. So go to 538.com/live for details and tickets. That's it. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
And before we go, I do also want to make one more plug. 538 now officially has merchandise. We've gotten requests throughout the years from listeners and readers, etc., asking us if we have merch. And the answer was always no. We just never really got our act together, I guess. Now the answer is yes. So if you want T-shirts and hats and tote bags and all of that good stuff, go to 538.com/store. We're going to put some more merchandise out there eventually. I've personally been lobbying for coasters with Nate's face on them. Those are not on the store yet.
It's not going to happen.
Are you sure? I think it might happen.
I have my right to publicity, and so I would have to sign off on that and get a royalty.
Oh, okay.
Oh, look at you.
It's wow. Not true, actually.
Okay,
that's
so we'll make... We'll make coasters then of Sarah, Perry, and me.
No, y'all have the same rights.
We do?
I am making this up as I go along.
I'll take it.
Anyway.
If you're putting your drink on Galen's face, I think Galen deserves like a penny for that.
So, yeah, apparently Stephanie Roos and Vanessa Diaz, they're responsible for putting all of this stuff together. I've talked to them about this, and they said that maybe in the future when we come up with, like, funny sayings on the podcast or whatever, we can make T-shirts out of them. We can have a competition where people can send in artwork and we can, like, make a mug. All kinds of possibilities for, like, crazy things we can do. So, anyway, 538.com/store. Looking forward to whatever crazy things we come up with. But that's it for now. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.